Chapter 25. How the Procurator Tried to Save Judas of Kiryat. Darkness descending from the Mediterranean Sea engulfed the city so hated by the Procurator. Gone were the suspended bridges connecting the temple to the fearsome Antonia Tower. Down came the void and flooded the winged gods over the Hippodrome, the Hasmonean Palace with its loopholes, the markets, the caravanserais, the alleys, the pools. Gone was Yerushalayim, the great city, gone as though it had never existed. Darkness had devoured all, striking fear into every living thing in Yerushalayim and its surroundings. The unusual storm cloud came by way of the sea at the end of the day, the 14th day of the spring month of Nisan. Its enormous belly rolled over the bald mountain where the executioners were hastily stabbing the condemned men. It rolled over the temple in Yerushalayim. It crept down the hill in smoky streams and flooded the lower city. It poured into windows and chased people inside from the crooked streets. It was in no hurry to give up its moisture, yielding only light. Each time the fire tore through the smoky black brew, the enormous hulk of the temple, with its shining scaly roof, emerged from the pitch blackness. But the fire would extinguish instantly and the temple slide back into the dark abyss. Several times it leapt out thus and fell back in, and every time its fall was accompanied by catastrophic thunder. Other trembling lights summoned the palace of Herod the Great from the abyss as it stood opposite the temple on the west hill, causing its hideous, eyeless golden statues to leap up into the black sky, stretching their arms towards it. But again, the heavenly fire would disappear, and the heavy claps of thunder would banish the golden idols back into the darkness. Suddenly, the downpour came, and the storm turned into a hurricane. By the marble bench in the garden, in the same spot where the procurator and the priest had spoken around midday, a cypress tree snapped like a twig, producing a sound worthy of a cannon shot. Torn roses, magnolia leaves, small twigs and sand swept under the columns on the balcony, along with watery spray and hailstones. The hurricane savaged the garden. Only one man remained under the columns at the time, and that man was the procurator. He no longer sat in a chair, but instead lay on a couch next to a small, low table laden with food and jugs of wine. A second couch stood empty on the other side of the table. A red, almost blood-like puddle was spreading by the procurator's feet amid the pieces of a broken jug. The servant, setting the procurator's table before the storm, wavered under Pilate's stare for some reason, afraid that he had somehow displeased his master. Growing angry, the procurator smashed the jug on the mosaic floor and said, "Why do you not look me in the face when you serve me? Or have you stolen something?" The African's black face turned grey, and a deathly fear appeared in his eyes. He trembled and almost smashed a second jug, but then the procurator's anger vanished as quickly as it had come. The African dashed to pick up the pieces and mop up the puddle, but the procurator waved him away and the slave disappeared, and the puddle remained. Now, during the hurricane, the African was hiding near a niche containing the white statue of a nude woman with a tilted head, afraid to appear at the wrong time, but at the same time worried he might miss the procurator's call. Lying on the couch in the stormy twilight, the procurator poured the wine into the cup himself, took long sips, reached for the bread occasionally, crumbled it, and ate the small pieces. From time to time he would suck out an oyster, chew on a lemon, and then take another drink. Were it not for the roaring waters, were it not for the thunderclaps that, it seemed, were threatening to flatten the palace roof, were it not for the rapping of hailstones as they hammered the steps of the balcony. One could have heard the procurator muttering something, talking to himself. Had the flickering heavenly light turned into steady illumination, an observer could have noticed that the procurator's face, with eyes inflamed by wine and the latest bouts of insomnia, bore an expression of impatience, that in between staring at the two white roses floating in the red puddle, the procurator was constantly turning his head towards the garden, towards the watery mist and the sand, that he was waiting for someone, waiting impatiently. After some time, the veil of water before the procurator's eyes began to grow thinner. As fierce as the hurricane had been, it began to weaken. Tree branches stopped creaking and falling to the ground. The thunderclaps and the flashes grew rarer. The purple shroud with white trim floating over Yerushalayim was replaced by an ordinary grey cloud, the rearguard of the storm being carried off towards the Dead Sea. It was now possible to hear the separate sounds of the rain and of water cascading down the gutters and over the very steps the procurator had walked on earlier in the day, before pronouncing the sentence in the square. Last came the sound of the hitherto muffled fountain. It grew lighter outside. Blue openings appeared in the grey veil as it fled eastward. Breaking through the now weak pattering of the rain, faint sounds of trumpets and the far-off chattering of several hundred hooves reached the procurator's ears. The procurator stirred up upon hearing the noise, and his face became livelier. The ailer was returning from Bald Mountain. Judging by the sound, it was crossing the same square where the sentence had been pronounced. At last, the procurator heard the long-awaited footsteps splashing on the staircase leading to the upper terrace of the garden, directly in front of the balcony. The procurator stretched out his neck, and his eyes glinted with happiness. The hooded head of a man appeared between the two marble lions, and the rest of him followed, completely drenched, his cloak clinging to his body. It was the same man who had whispered with the procurator in a darkened palace room before the sentencing, and who sat on a three-legged stool during the execution, playing with a twig. Ignoring the puddles, the hooded man crossed the garden terrace and stepped onto the mosaic floor of the balcony. Raising his hand, he said in a pleasant, high-pitched voice, "Health and happiness to the procurator." The visitor spoke Latin. "Ye gods," Pilate exclaimed, "there's not a dry stitch on you. Some hurricane, no? Please go inside immediately. Do me a favour and change." The visitor tossed back his hood, revealing a completely wet head, his hair plastered to his forehead. With a polite smile on his clean-shaven face, he began to protest, assuring the procurator that a little rain would not hurt him. "I won't hear of it," Pilate replied, and clapped his hands, thus summoning the hiding servants. He instructed them to take care of the visitor and then immediately serve a hot meal. It did not take the procurator's visitor long to dry his hair, change his clothing and shoes, and otherwise make himself presentable. Soon he appeared on the balcony, wearing dry sandals and a crimson military cloak, his hair neatly slicked down. Meanwhile, the sun returned to Yerushalayim. Before leaving to drown in the Mediterranean Sea, it sent parting rays towards the city so hated by the procurator, gilding the steps of the balcony. The fountain regained its liveliness and hummed along at full strength. Pigeons appeared on the ground, cooing and hopping over broken branches, pecking at something in the wet sand. The red puddle had been mopped up, the broken pieces removed, and meat was steaming on the table.
"I await the procurator's orders," said the visitor, approaching the table.
"You will hear nothing until you sit and have some wine," Pilate said amiably, and gestured at the second couch. The visitor reclined, and a servant poured thick red wine into his cup. Leaning carefully over Pilate's shoulder,
Another servant filled the cup of the procurator, who then waved both servants away. While the visitor ate and drank, Pilate sipped his wine and watched his guest with narrowed eyes. His visitor was a middle-aged man with a very pleasant face, round and neat, with a fleshy nose. His hair was of an indeterminate colour. Right now it was growing lighter as it dried. His nationality would have been difficult to establish. The defining feature of his face was probably its good-natured look, contrasted, however, by his eyes, or more precisely, his manner of looking at others. The visitor normally kept his small eyes half covered by his oddly shaped, almost puffy eyelids. The slits would shine with passive slyness, leading one to suppose that the procurator's guest had a penchant for humour. But occasionally, the visitor would banish all trace of glinting humour from the slits, open wide his eyes, and unleash a sudden piercing stare, as if scrutinising some inconspicuous blemish on his interlocutor's face. This would last but a moment, and then the eyelids would fall again, the eyes would narrow into slits and again glitter with good nature and sly wit. The visitor did not refuse a second cup of wine either. He swallowed a few oysters with visible satisfaction, tried the steamed vegetables, and ate a piece of meat. Satiated, he praised the wine. "An excellent vintage, procurator. But it is not Falernian, is it?" "Cucuba, aged 30 years, the procurator replied amiably. The guest pressed his hand to his heart and refused to eat any more, declaring that he was full. Pilate then refilled his cup, and the guest followed suit. Both diners poured some wine onto the platter of meat, and raising his cup, the procurator pronounced loudly, "To us, and to you, Caesar, father of all Romans, the best and most precious of men." They finished their wine, and the Africans cleared the table of food, leaving only the fruit and the jugs. The procurator again motioned the servants away and remained alone with his guest under the colonnade. "And so," Pilate spoke quietly, "what can you tell me of the sentiment in this city?" Involuntarily, he directed his gaze down past the garden terraces where colonnades and flat roofs burned with gold colour in the last rays of the sun. "I believe that the mood in Yerushalayim is now satisfactory, procurator," the guest replied.
"So you can vouch that the civil unrest will not recur?"
"One can vouch but for one thing in this world," replied the guest, gazing affectionately at the procurator. "The might of the great Caesar."
"May the gods grant him long life," Pilate picked up instantly, "and universal peace." After a brief silence, he continued, "So you believe that the troops may now be withdrawn?"
"I believe that the cohort of the lightning may leave," the guest replied, and added, "It would be good if it paraded through the city on its way out."
"An excellent idea," the procurator approved. "The day after tomorrow I shall let it go and leave myself. And furthermore, as I swear by the Feast of the 12 Gods, swear by the Lares, I would give much to be able to do so today."
"The procurator does not like Yerushalayim?" the guest inquired good-naturedly.
"Please," the procurator exclaimed, smiling, "there is no place more hopeless in the world. I won't even mention the climate. I'm ill every time I have to come here, but that's half the trouble. But these festivals, these magicians, sorcerers, wizards, these flocks of pilgrims, fanatics, fanatics. Why, take that Messiah," they suddenly began to await the sheer. "At any moment you can expect to witness most unpleasant acts of bloodshed, shifting troops all the time, reading accusations and complaints, half of which are directed at you. You must agree, it is all quite boring. Oh, were it not for the imperial service."
"Yes, the festivals here are quite difficult," the guest agreed.
"I wish with all my heart that they be over as soon as possible," Pilate added energetically. "I will finally be able to return to Caesarea.
Would you believe it? but this is Herod's insane handiwork. The procurator waved at the colonnade, making it clear that he was referring to the palace. It's driving me positively mad. I cannot spend the nights here. The world has never seen stranger architecture.
Yeah, but let us get back to business. First of all, is that accursed Bar Rabban giving you any trouble?
Here the guest directed his peculiar stare at the procurator's cheek. But the latter was gazing off into the distance indifferently, frowning with distaste as he contemplated the part of the city lying at his feet and fading into the dusk. The guest's eyes faded as well, and his eyelids lowered.
"I expect that Bar is now harmless as a lamb," the guest said, and wrinkles appeared on his round face. "It is rather inconvenient for him to riot now."
"Too famous?" Pilate asked with a smirk.
"The procurator has subtle insight into the matter, as always."
"But at any rate," the procurator noted with some concern, and his long, thin finger, decorated by a ring with a black stone, rose in the air, "we should..."
"Oh, the procurator may be assured that as long as I am in Judea, Bar will not make a step without someone following on his heels."
"Then I am at ease, as, coincidentally, I always am with you around."
"The procurator is too kind."
"And now I will ask you to tell me about the execution," the procurator said.
"What in particular interests the procurator?"
"Were there any attempts to express discontent on the part of the crowd? That's the main question, of course."
"None,"
the guest replied.
"Very well. You personally ascertain that the men were dead?"
"The procurator may rest assured of it."
"But tell me, were they given a drink before being hung on the posts?"
"Yes, but he..."
The guest closed his eyes.
"He refused to drink it."
"Who, exactly?" Pilate asked.
"Forgive me, hegemon,"
the guest exclaimed.
"Did I not say Hanotsri?"
"Madman," Pilate said, grimacing for some reason.
A vein began to twitch under his left eye.
"To die under the scorching sun? Why refuse that which is allowed by law? How did he motivate his refusal?"
"He said that he was grateful,"
the guest replied, again closing his eyes,
"and that he does not blame those who take away his life."
"Who?" Pilate asked in a hollow voice.
"That he did not say, hegemon."
"Did he attempt to preach anything in the soldiers' presence?"
"No, hegemon, he spoke little on this occasion. The only thing he said was that he considered cowardice to be one of the main human vices."
"What was he referring to?"
The guest heard the procurator's voice crack suddenly.
"It was impossible to tell. He behaved strangely. As always, however."
"Strangely? In what way?"
"He kept trying to look into the eyes of those around him, and kept smiling a confused sort of smile."
"Nothing else?" asked the hoarse voice.
"Nothing else."
The procurator banged his cup as he poured himself wine. Downing it all, he spoke, "The problem is this. Although we've not been able to find any of his worshippers or followers, for the time being at least, we cannot assume that they do not exist."
Tilting his head, the guest listened intently.
"Thus, to avoid any surprises," continued the procurator, "I ask you to quickly and quietly remove the bodies of all three executed men from the face of the earth and bury them in secrecy and in silence, so that nothing more is heard of them."
"I understand, hegemon,"
the guest said, and rose.
"In the light of the seriousness and complexity of the matter, please allow me to depart immediately."
"No, be seated a moment longer," said Pilate, stopping his guest with a gesture. "There are two more questions. The first is this. Your outstanding service in a most difficult position as overseer of the secret service for the procurator of Judea affords me the pleasant opportunity to mention you in Rome." The guest's face turned pink. He rose and bowed to the procurator, saying, "I only fulfill my duty in the imperial service."
"But I would like to ask you," the hegemon continued, "to refuse a promotional transfer if one is offered to you and remain here. I would hate to part with you. Let them reward you in some other way."
"I am happy to serve under your command, hegemon."
"I'm very pleased. And thus the second question concerning this, Judas of Kiryat." The guest directed his stare at the procurator and promptly extinguished it as before.
"They say," continued the procurator, lowering his voice, "that he received money for his warm reception of that mad philosopher."
"Will receive,"
the overseer of the Secret Service corrected quietly.
"Is it a large sum?"
"That no one knows, hegemon."
"Not even you?"
asked the hegemon, expressing a compliment with his amazement.
"Alas, not even I," the guest replied calmly. "But I do know that he will receive this money tonight. He is being summoned to Caiaphas' palace."
"Ah, that greedy old man from Kiryat," said the procurator, smiling. "He is an old man, is he not?"
"The procurator never errs, but this time he has," the guest replied amiably. "The man from Kiryat is a young man."
"You don't say. Can you describe him for me? A fanatic?"
"Not at all, procurator."
"Right. Anything else?"
"Very handsome."
"What else? Perhaps he has some passion or another?"
"It is difficult to know everyone so well in this enormous city, procurator."
"No, no, Afranius, don't play down your merits."
"He has one passion, procurator."
The guest made the tiniest of pauses.
"Passion for money."
"What does he do?"
Afranius raised his eyes to the ceiling, thought, and answered,
"He works at a money changer's shop owned by one of his relatives."
"Right, right, right."
The procurator fell silent, glanced round to make sure there was no one else on the balcony, and said quietly,
"Here's the thing. I have received information that he will be murdered tonight."
At this point, not only did the guest cast his glance at the procurator, but even held it for a little while, and then replied,
"You speak too kindly of me, procurator. It seems I do not deserve your favourable report. I have no such information."
"You deserve the highest reward," replied the procurator.
"But the information exists. If I may be so bold as to ask, where does this information come from?"
"Allow me to withhold that from you for the moment, especially since it is all quite accidental, obscure, and unreliable. However, it is my duty to foresee all. It is my job, and furthermore, I am inclined to trust my instincts, as they have never misled me in the past. The information consists of this. One of Harnotsri's secret followers, outraged at this money changer's monstrous betrayal, is conspiring with his accomplices to kill him tonight. As for the payment received for the betrayal, it will be brought back to Caifa along with a note. I return the cursed money."
The overseer of the Secret Service cast no more of his unexpected glances at the procurator, and continued listening with narrowed eyes as Pilate continued.
"Imagine, would the high priest enjoy receiving such a gift on the night of the festival?"
"Not only would he not enjoy it," replied the guest, smiling, "but I believe it would cause quite the scandal, procurator."
"I am of the same opinion. As a result, I ask you to attend to this matter, that is, take all the necessary measures to protect Judas of Kiryat."
"The hegemon's orders will be carried out,"
Afranius said.
But permit me to allay the hegemon's fears. The villain's plot will be quite difficult to pull off. Just think," the guest glanced round as he spoke and continued, "to seek out a man, kill him, find out how much money he has received, and manage to return the sum to Caïpha all in one night, tonight."
"And nonetheless he will be killed tonight," Pilate repeated stubbornly.
"I can feel it, I tell you. Not once have I been wrong."
A spasm passed over the procurator's face, and he rubbed his hands briefly.
"Understood,"
the guest replied obediently. He rose, straightened himself, and asked sternly,
"So they will kill him, hegemon?"
"Yes," Pilate replied. "The only hope lies in your amazing abilities." The guest adjusted his heavy belt under his cloak and said,
"I salute you, and wish you good health and happiness."
"Oh, yes," Pilate exclaimed quietly. "I almost forgot. I owe you."
The guest was amazed.
"Truly, Procurator, you owe me nothing."
"I certainly do. When we rode into Yerushalayim, if you recall, the crowd of beggars, I wanted to throw some money at them, but had none on my person, so I borrowed from you."
"Why, it's a trifle, Procurator."
"Even trifles ought to be remembered." Pilate turned round and picked up a cloak from the seat behind him. He extracted a leather bag from underneath it and handed it to his guest. The latter bowed as he accepted it and hid it under his cloak.
"I await your report on the burial," said Pilate,
"as well as regarding the matter of this Judas of Kiryat. This same night, do you hear me, Ephraimus? This same night. The guards will be instructed to wake me as soon as you arrive. I'll be waiting for you."
"I salute you,"
the overseer of the secret service said, and turned to leave the balcony. His feet crunched on the wet sand of the terrace. Then came the tapping of his boots on the marble steps between the lions. His legs disappeared from sight, followed by his torso, and finally his head. Only then did the procurator notice that the sun was gone and that twilight had come.